one of 12 who survived, you know, brothers and sisters, and they all had lots of children. And the story is that when Chaim Weizmann came to New York years ago, and made a presentation at the old Madison Square Garden, there was a whole balcony with a banner, relatives of Chaim Weizmann. And there were hundreds of them, you know, because every family had many, many children. But my father had told me that he was this cousin. And he had seen him in Pinsk when Weizmann was a student there. My father was quite a bit younger. You know, I think about 8 or 9 years younger than Chaim. And I saw in a biography that his father's name was Fialkov. And so I wrote to the biographer, Isaiah Berlin, and said, "How come?" And he said it had some, he thinks it had something to do with the service in the Tsar's army. And, you know, I was curious to learn more about it. And actually, I found a biographer that told us that there were 7 sons in that family. And the 2 youngest kept the name Fialkov because they were not of draft age.
Sure.
And the 5 olders took names of family in town that had no sons, because if you were the only son in a family, you were exempt from the draft into the Tsar's army, after which they never heard from you again.
Yeah, 25-year service.
So the names were Shapiro, Rosenzweig, Berman, you know, many other names. But then when I got to Israel and went to the Weizmann Institute, and there was a picture of his father, Eitzel Weizmann Fialkov. Hmm. So, you know, it was an interesting, fancy relationship. Not that, you know, so there's some DNA in there, but that's...
You never got in contact with any of the family of Weizmann?
No,
I mean, never
was in contact with them.
That might have been,
you know, because there were...
I know there were an army of them.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of his descendants. I really don't know how many children he might have had.
Who?
Weizmann Chaim.
He had, you know, quite a few. Awesome. And, of course, one son was also named Eitzel, like his father. Was a military man in Israel with a history, and actually wrote a book. But I thought it was interesting to note that there was some chemistry in my DNA, but not that it meant anything. My major problem with chemistry was when I returned from service. I returned from service and had previously gone to City College, and they allocated, when I went to NYU, they allocated credits depending upon what I had done at City College. And I had studied a year of chemistry at City College, but this was, you know, many years later, and they gave me credit for half the course, not the full course. And when I studied chemistry, the final half at NYU, where I was going for my degree at night, I was doing fine. But what happened was, when they gave the final exam, it was on the total
year.
And I didn't know any of the problems that took place you know, before. 9 years earlier or whatever. And so I got an A in the lab work,
right,
and a D in the only D I received at NYU.
Right.
Everything else was A and B's, no C's.
Yeah.
So, and I wasn't, you know, I was graduating up, you know, in the top 5% of the class, and it didn't bother, didn't bother me, but it kept me from getting a degree with honor.
Well, yeah, and I know those introductory courses in chemistry, they involve a lot of memorization stuff, so you have to remember the color of ions and stuff.
And when I took that final exam, I just flabbergasted because it wasn't anything we had covered during the semester.
Right, and it's not something you needed to know in a sense. It was just something that was a memorization.
At any rate,
before.
You know, because all my grades at NYU were A's and B's. But that was chemistry. And as I told you once before, when I became involved in semiconductors, I went to my chemistry book and asked, looked for germanium and says, we won't discuss it, it has no commercial uses. Smith's College Chemistry, I still remember the name of the text.
So was the connection to the Wiseman family, that was something that you had heard about as a younger person and then really explored as an adult?
My father had told me
that
he was a cousin.
Okay.
And but then there was a biography by several authors, and Isaiah Berlin, who was in London at that time, wrote that his father's name was Fialkov. And I wrote to him, and he sent me and advised me to get in touch with the archivist at the Weizmann Institute, which I did, and he explained the story about service in the Tsar's army. And how I learned I came from a family of draft dodgers.
Well, yeah. Everyone tried to avoid the Russian army.
Was a connection then to, were there a strong connect? Did you have a lot of family in Israel that you were in contact with then when you were growing up? Or
no.
Was there, yeah.
No. I had some family in Israel that mostly came from my mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
Because my grandmother was one of six siblings, and their name was Bacher, B-A-C-H-E-R, and most of them emigrated to Canada. And we had reunions every couple of years, and called the Bacher family reunion. Some of them pronounced it Bacher, some pronounced it Backer, but it was spelled B-A-C-H-E-R. And so somewhere I have a whole family tree from that family, and there were hundreds who came to the reunions, but it finally stopped. But it's on the internet. You can keep in contact.
And some of them emigrated to Israel? Some of your mothers?
Some of them.
From Canada? Or?
No, from Europe.
From Romania, as I remember. That's where your mother was from. Am I correct?
My mother was from Austria-Hungary.
But the Romanian part.
But it became part of Romania after World War I.
Transylvania, probably.
It was in the northern Carpathian mountain region.
Right.
Almost adjacent, almost next to Russia.
Right.
And the area was called Bukovina.
Oh, okay. I know that area.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. It used to be part of the Polish kingdom at one time, too.
Yeah.
And they have these very interesting... Have you been there?
No.
Oh, they have these very interesting Orthodox churches. The very curious roof. And the paintings are on the outside of the building, and the roof is that way in order to shield it from the rain. And they're quite impressive. It's small things, but it's very impressive area. And that was a part of Europe that changed hands many times. It was Turkish, it was Polish, it was
actually, we had dinner last night at a cousin who was a survivor of the Holocaust. She lives close by in Boynton Beach, and we had dinner at their house. And that's from the mother's side. My grandson, Joshua, is really the family historian. He has looked into everything, where we came from and so on. And so he's taken over the job.
Well, I thought maybe we could, maybe we should shift gears a little bit then, and talk talk a little bit about your history of semiconductor-related investments. And I thought one thing I might ask you would be to talk about before your formal career in venture investing, which I guess begins. Is it 1967 that it
began? 68.
In 68.
Actually, I was a limited partner much earlier in 1961 of a venture capital fund called Davis and Rock.
Oh.
Arthur Rock.
Sure.
Arthur Rock was a young man in the investment banking field, and they were our investment bankers at General Transistor, so I knew him. And when he left and went to California and started a venture capital fund, I invested $100,000 as part of it. I think it was just several million dollars. And he made some very successful investments, and I think it came out to about $2 million when it finished.
And how, what was the, so that was the first Davis and Rock fund?
That was the first Davis and Rock fund. And actually he invested in my first venture capital fund in 1968. And the last contact I had with him was 7 years ago. And I wanted him to know that because of him, I have two grandsons in the venture capital business. And you know, he, you know, so we had some correspondence then, but I haven't seen him since.
Now, so was that thinking of investing in a venture capital fund in 1961, I would imagine was not the most common of things to be doing. You know, that the venture cap, the whole dynamics of venture capital were really in relatively early days at that time. Is
yes.
that correct? Yeah.
Yes, but he invested in Teledyne, which started a semiconductor or acquired a semiconductor operation. His investment, when he invested in Intel, of course, he was the he rounded out their first investment, and my first fund invested $100,000 in Intel, which of course we didn't keep long enough for it to be worth $1 billion. But that's life.
Well, I was
but even before then, I was on the board of a company in Long Island, which sold its assets, I'm trying to remember, to another company and became sort of a public investment company. And we invested in American Microsystems when it started. And I, you know, and that worked out okay.
Well, I was just wondering in terms of, I guess my question about the 1961 and your participation in that first Davis and Rock Fund was, That seems like a very, you know, it's an unusual sort of investment for someone to make. I was just wondering how you came
to
participate in it. Did Arthur Rock approach you? Did he have to sell you on the idea of venture investing, or?
No. The history is as follows. When I was at General Transistor, we had just expanded and acquired a factory in Rhode Island, in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, and we were busy getting that going. And Arthur came to me and wanted General Transistor to invest in this group of five or six people that ultimately was backed by Fairchild. And I told him, I've just got my hands full right now. And, you know, so I turned it down. This was the Fairchild group. Mm-hmm. I think there were six of them, John Hooney, Jay Lass, several others, and of course, Bob Noyes. And so having missed that investment, I decided to take, not to say no to him again. And so when he came up with the idea for a venture capital fund, I said, I'm joining you. He raised money for Teledyne, and I participated in that as well. That I did as a personal thing before the venture capital fund. And so, you know, the story is I would never say no to the Rock again.
Because by that time, Fairchild Semiconductor had become a very successful operation.
Actually, at the very beginning, the investment in Intel was a personal investment. But when I started the fund, I got approval from everybody to throw that into the fund, into Geiger and Fialka.
Mm.
Oh, I see.
Were you, I'm just wondering again back to doing venture cap, participating in a venture fund in 1961. Who were the, could you describe what sort of communications you would get from Davis and Rock about what was going on?
Sure.
Or would you meet the other limited partners?
Sure.
Could you just
Jay List? Jay List was a member of my fund. And so, you know, I followed what was going on. And of course, Arthur gave us quarterly reports, which I don't think I've saved, but maybe I have someplace in storage. Is that of interest to you? If I find it?
I think it would be very interesting to see. Did the investors in something like Davis and Rock or Geiger and Fialkov, was there ever a time when the investors met together with you, or was it through correspondence generally and telephone calls, or how did that work?
I think in the early days of venture capital with Arthur in California, I don't think he had annual meetings with investors that they attended. Of course, we did at Geiger and Fialkov, and most venture funds do have an annual meeting. The one I'm still connected with, you know, as a non-participant, except as a small general partner, is they have annual meetings.
Where the investors physically come together with the managers.
And at
the
these annual meetings, they usually have three or four of their portfolio companies make presentations, you know,
mm-hmm.
especially the more successful ones.
And for for that first Davison Rock Fund, that had a certain lifetime. Couple years, was it?
7 years.
7 years. Was that sort of standard practice for venture funds in the 60s that at the outset?
It later became 10 years. But at the beginning, it was just 7 years.
Okay. So people knew that their investment was, you know, committed for that period of time.
Sometimes you extended it a year or two in order to have liquidity. But it was normally something that you expected to have a finite life.
Through your experience with General Transistor, General Instrument, up until this period of the 60s, or including during the 60s, did you have increasing interactions with Wall Street and the investment community in terms of handling, for example, the stock of General Transistor, the stock of General
Absolutely.
Instrument?
You know, I spoke to the analysts. We had a spoke, and every time we had a public offering, you had to make the rounds of all the major brokers throughout the country. So I did that. I did that for General Transistor. I did it for Standard Microsystems, where I served as president for a while and then as chairman. And so I was involved in their public offerings. And at Standard Microsystems, I think I traveled 100,000 miles a year. By ear, you know, because I was involved in their private financings and in their, you know, public financings.
In your
and we had a facility in California.
Right. In thinking about the period of the, before you started Geiger and Fialkov, was, I'm just wondering about that group, the sort of investment and finance community at that time. Was it a smaller group of people? Were you seeing sort of the same people interacting with the same individuals time and again? Or was it more that you were dealing with the same organizations time and again? Was it personal, or?
I had met many of the people who were investors in Davison Rock.
Okay.
And some of them served on boards on which I served. In other words, there was a connection. Arthur was an investor in the Benrus Watch Company. And since he was in California and didn't serve on New York boards, I served on it. And there were, I'm trying to remember names, but they don't, at my age, they don't come to me quickly.
Mm.
A fellow's name was Sandy, something or other. Also served on the Benrus board and was also one of the Intel board members. And you know, so there was interaction among the people who had invested with Arthur Rock. Mm.
And it would be,
and especially with those who later become, those of the Fairchild people who later moved to other semiconductor companies. Some of them moved to the semiconductor company formed by Teledyne. And as I told you, Jay Last was an investor in my venture fund.
Maybe we could talk, another question I had actually was, when you were doing your personal investing, prior to getting involved with venture capital in the 60s, did you have a strategy for your personal investing that you carried over with you into your venture capital investing?
I think most of the personal investments in ventures was through off the rock at that time.
Okay.
I didn't pursue it on my own, but my partner in the first fund, who was Richard Geiger, and I served on a board of a company in Long Island that I told you sold its assets, I think, to Varian, and then invested that money in ventures, including AMI, when it started. So, you know, I was on the board of a small investment company that later changed its name to Standard Resources.
Right.
And Standard Resources was the investor, put up the money. I was chairman of the board at that time, put up the money to form the group that ultimately became Standard Microsystems. And the profit that Micro Semiconductor Company, the name was changed to Micro Semiconductor, Micro Semi now, I think. And the money they made on their stock in Standard Microsystems helped them become a strong, profitable company, and they're alive and kicking today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I one time had the opportunity to do a short interview with Arthur Rock, and I asked him about, you know, what was his strategy? You know, how did he pick these ventures to invest in, and you know, how would he keep abreast of all the technology to be able to do that? And he said, well, I don't really follow all the technologies. I choose to invest with people. And I was wondering, was that something you talked with him about in this period?
Oh, sure.
Could you talk about what that concept was, or just about that?
You wanted people who you felt would devote their life and energy to the company and never quit. And of course, you know, you were looking to invest. Most of the really successful ventures that I invested in when they were startups. And so you were going on the basis of people.
Hmm. And you knew them well enough.
And you judged them, and you knew them. You know, it was before you used psychologists to interview them and tell you something about them. You know, you had to make judgments on people. You know, if you run into people who start a company and then live a normal life, take vacations when it's vacation time and so on, that isn't who you want. You want people who really devote all their energy to succeeding. Hmm. And, you know, you look for people who are intelligent and bright.
But you're also looking for that dedication, if you will.
Absolutely. What happens is there's so much trouble in the early days of any venture, so that the guy is a quitter, it's gone.
Mm. Because there will be inevitably a whole host of problems in the early days.
That is right.
Mm. And so,
go ahead,
Richard.
Yeah. Because the people that I can understand that very easily, and we both do. But I'm just curious, these were people that you already knew very well, or did you have that capacity in a short period of time to evaluate them?
No, it isn't people whom you knew well. invested in a couple of Israeli companies, you know, with some, you know, but they were very successful. And DSB Group, which is still a public company, DSB Resources, which they spun off and which was sold to Intel for $1.7 billion, and Opal, which was sold, what's the California semiconductor?
I have it somewhere in here, hold on.
We sold them to...
Applied Materials.
Applied Materials. That was a very successful one. But these were people, who don't give up.
And you had the gift of analyzing and assessing an individual in that way.
Right. And you didn't want to keep backing people who weren't devoting 100% of their energy.
Because I'm just curious how you acquire that ability to... And I know you probably can't answer that, but I mean, that, for me, it's very interesting because I can meet someone and I'm not able to evaluate them in that way. In other words, I don't have that capacity. You had that, and I'm just find that interesting.
Yeah.
What did you base that on? How, I mean, I understand you want to find someone who won't give up, who will devote all their energies to success, but how do you know in a conversation that that's the person you meet?
With some people, you learn it in the first conversation.
Really? What are the tells that give you that? I hope I'm not diverting the conversation.
I don't know.
It's just something instinctual.
You know, the guy is selling himself, and selling his past experiences as well, and you see what happened there, and
and you see that he had that drive then.
I could tell at the first 2-3 hour meeting
what this guy was.
Right.
Okay.
No, you didn't want. You didn't want losers. And I can't tell you how.
I wish you could, but it would be a very useful skill to walk away with. But.
Yeah. Well, it seems that am I correct that the genre of investments that both Davis and Rock was making and also Geiger and Fialkov was making in this early period, these were investments in technology-based companies. Is that right?
Not exclusively, but I think at Geiger and Fialkov it was technology. Mm-hmm. Arthur invested in other companies as well, like financial companies.
Okay, I didn't realize that. I guess because the stories of his, the successes of their investments.
But the major successes were in semiconductors.
But they were also, as you mentioned, making investments in things like a watch company.
Yeah.
Which I guess is really
about. It's a friend of his from college, you know.
Again, an investment in people.
Yeah. And he graduated from Harvard with this fellow who acquired Benrus, and they acquired a jewelry company called Wells and became Wells Benrus.
Well, I was wondering that my question is really about the balance between when you're making an investment in a technology company, a semiconductor company, let's say, or semiconductor-related company. On the one hand, you're trying to evaluate the people, their capacities, their passion and dedication. But you've also got to...
look at their experience.
But I would also think, make sure that their technology story rings true, that this seems like something that you could do and could derive profit.
We invested at Geiger and Fialkoff in a group who were an outstanding development group for the National Security Agency. And they had worked on software, you know, and semiconductor equipment that would, for the NSA, that would make sure that all the communications had like 0% possibilities of being wrong. And we invested in them because we knew that they were an outstanding design group, but they chose the wrong product. I mean, the world didn't want that product. And they could just as easily have been the first one to come up with a computer with their knowledge and so on. And when I found the group and hired the group, Paul Richmond's group, to start Standard, that ultimately became Standard Microsystems, I wanted to tie that in and merge it with the other.
That made
the
sense.
Other group. And, but they didn't want to. And you can't force them to merge, even though we controlled the company. And they sold out. When it came time to merge the companies, they decided they would rather sell to AMI. And so they merged into AMI. And we were left without a design group. And so we had to go find one. But you know, they were very distrustful of us Northerners, you know. They were a very strange kind of people. But they were fantastic designers in the earliest days of semiconductor equipment.
Right. That's interesting.
That was an MOS, integrated circuit design group?
I don't know if it was MOS, but they accomplished what they projected on scheduled cost, perfectly, because they had done it before at NSA.
Right.
But it wasn't the right product.
Right.
And so here they were, what they promised, they succeeded in, but they didn't have anybody among them who knew how to go out and talk to customers and find out what they wanted and what they didn't want.
That's interesting.
And that's a very important part of a business. When I started General Transistor, I was at the customers every month.
That's interesting. I mean, because one thing is they filled one of your criteria in terms of their dedication and talent and drive, but there's one component missing, which is the ability to evaluate the marketplace.
Right. You know, these people never went out and talked to the potential customers and found out, well, maybe they wanted this and not that.
So that was a lesson learned for you after that, when you evaluated people, you looked at investment opportunities. You also wanted to see that there were people there who understood the customer.
You wanted to help them broaden their management group to be able to sell and market. Marketing and sales in an early stage company, you know, you can't live without it.
I was just thinking about the winning formula for finding in making an investment in terms of the people and what you look for.
No, because we felt we could always
get them to do it.
Help them do it.
Yeah. So the people.
I mean, that was a major job we had as board members, is not to control the company, but to help them succeed.
Right. So either they, if they didn't have the market savvy, then they had to be open to new ideas.
Right. Yeah. And these people were not.
Yeah.
They wanted to do what they knew how to do.
That's a familiar thing. A familiar problem.
And, you know, it was a shame to lose them.
A couple, I've heard people mention that there's been a change in the practice of venture capital investing between, in general, between what groups in maybe the earlier period did and what groups kind of today do.
The later groups wanted MBAs and, you know, and being a graduate of Wharton or Harvard or whatever is an MBA didn't assure us as venture capital investors, you know, that that's who all the growing venture firms hired. And these were non-technical people. And, you know, the world is running on technology. And you need people who understand something about the technology. And
this is on the side of the people choosing which investments to make.
Right.
The distinction that I've heard people talk about is between venture investors who also bring to the firms that they're investing in also bring these aids, if you will, as you were talking about, where they bring expertise through their board participation, but they also connect the firm they're investing in into networks that they have with other people. So they say, oh, here's a good marketing person. Here's
Absolutely.
A good sales person. Here's a good lawyer. Has that changed over time? So do venture funds today contribute those same...
They're supposed to. And some of them do, and some of them don't. You know, most of them have... most of the large venture funds have experience in raising money, you know, because... What you have to do with these successful ventures is you constantly need financing to grow. And so they became mostly Wall Street types. And those who also had the many venture funds have successful entrepreneurs involved in them.
Yes.
And those are the best bets.
The best funds.
Right.
As a sort of a, just a, maybe a little bit of a sideline, but to follow up on a story that you pointed to, your investment in AMI, American Microsystems, and connected to this group that you design group that you invested in. In the 1960s, was AMI one of the first pure MOS integrated circuit companies?
I think so.
Do you recall around when your investment in them took place?
To be after they sold their assets. It probably had to be somewhere in the mid-1960s.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is just when that company started.
Yeah. You invested in it as a startup.
As a startup. I was now I've heard that we're all familiar with how successful MOS integrated circuits have become in general, that they've become the dominant form of integrated circuit. But it's my understanding that in the middle 1960s, that bipolar integrated circuits were by far the more common form of integrated circuit.
Right.
And that there was a time in the mid-60s where the primary customers for MOS integrated circuits were the government and operations like the National Security Agency. So two questions. One, is that your experience, or is that true? And two, was part of the proposition of American Microsystems that they were going to be selling into the government as their customer?
I think their interest was in selling to the Japanese, not
for calculators. Okay.
Yeah. And MOS was limited until Standard Microsystems started making the N-channel MOS,
mm-hmm.
and started licensing Intel and IBM and so on their Coplemos process. And we had hoped to our first product was a memory chip that was equivalent to four of Intel's in size, and unfortunately we were an upstart company and people didn't want to bet on us, and when we showed the product, they were told by Texas Instruments that they would have it in a year, and they waited. They didn't want to, they didn't want to bet on a startup company. So we never got into the memory business.
This was the competition for, that would have been the 4K DRAM
yes.
generation.
Right.
Where there was a lot of...
Yeah.
Fierce competition.
We were the first to offer it, but they were willing to wait for the promises from others.
Right.
With whom, they had greater confidence.
What happened to AMI, American Microsystems? Do you recall what?
I think they were taken over by the Japanese.
Oh, bought by a Japanese firm.
Yes.
Hitachi or one of those? Or
I don't remember which one.
Primarily for calculator
yeah.
stuff. Interesting. Well, I wanted to ask you some questions about your investments in Teledyne. And just the initial vision for Teledyne, and then how Teledyne developed over time, or
Teledyne was when we invested in it was an equipment company, really selling to the government, and I invested in it just because Arthur Rock was raising money for it, and. My investment was in my name, but I had a partner, which was one of my buddies at General Transistor. And, we ultimately sold it and made some money. But Arthur Rock's fund did very well with Teledyne.
Did Arthur Rock's fund that you were invested in also, did it hold Teledyne for longer than you had as an individual?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
If it was 7 years long, had Teledyne started on its famous strategy of becoming this conglomerate during the 60s, or was that
later on?
Was later on. Did you have any interaction at all with Henry Singleton or form any impressions of him?
Not really. You know, I met him.
Yeah.
His other partner, who ultimately went to a university in Texas, I don't remember his name.
I think it's something like George Kosmetsky or something.
Kosmetsky.
I can't remember exactly.
That's right, yeah. Kosmetsky. He's a bright fellow. But Henry Singleton, you know, was a successful person already.
Oh, by the time of Teledyne.
And, you know, he had built up a company, name of which I don't remember, and was going to do the same thing with Teledyne. Really selling government equipment, electronic equipment.
Now, Jay Last and Jean Arnais were right there in the formation of Teledyne with their semiconductor part of it. Did you know Jay Last or Jean Arnais?
Of course.
You knew them by that time through?
Yes.
Through Arthur Rock.
Right. We invested in Horney's first company. After Teledyne, I'm trying to remember the name of that.
Well, he did something, I think after he left Imelco, he did something with Union Carbide. And then he did...
He started a
Intersil,
company.
I think.
Intersil. That's right. I think they're both deceased by now.
Jay Last is alive, but Jean...
Jay Last is alive?
Yeah, but Jean Arnais...
Jean Arnais died.
Died, yeah. So did you invest in Intersil through Geiger and Fialkov?
No.
Through?
We didn't invest in Intersil.
Oh, you didn't invest in Intersil, okay.
You know, by the time that came about, Geiger and Fialkov was not investing anymore. You know,
right.
They'd been fully invested and we were waiting, you know, to liquidate.
So I guess by the time, so your involvement with Teledyne sort of wrapped up by the time that Davis and Rock was finished.
Yes.
Now, the first Davis and Rock was 1961, that would mean about the time that you started Geiger and Fialkov, they must have...
Geiger and Fialkov was started in 1968.
Right. So the first Davis and Rock...
I started Geiger and Fialkov when Davis and Rock was liquidating.
Right. That's what I was trying to work out the timing.
Right.
And then did Davis and Rock start another... They had two funds, or...?
They started a fund subsequent to that, but I was not involved in that.
Because you were involved with your own, primarily. Was your participation in the first Davis and Rock the end of your investing with Arthur Rock, or I mean, there's the Intel investment that you're making.
He made that separately. You know, Intel was in Geiger and Fialkov, but what was the next one he invested in that was a major success? He said he invested that. Not part of a venture fund.
In 1960s.
You caught me at an advanced age. My memory is not great.
There's a lot of things.
Well, there was this. Scientific data was.
Yeah, scientific data.
Was that around the time?
Scientific data was in Davis and Rock.
Right.
And that was sold to Xerox for about $1 billion.
Right.
So when he liquidated Davis and Rock, we got a lot of Xerox stock. Mm. That was probably one of the major, that Teledyne, was one of the major winners in his fund, in the first Davis and Rock fund. As I said, $100,000 investment turned into $2 million.
Then did you take your sort of proceeds from Davis and Rock and put that into Geiger and Fialkoff?
I invested $1 million in my own Geiger and Fialkoff fund.
Right.
As a limited partner. So.
So when you did, I guess the investment of Geiger and Fialkoff in Intel was in a way a no-brainer if you had, both the people with such a track record and Arthur Rock championing it. I can see that would have been a pretty clear one to do.
Yeah, the computer company was run by Max Pilevsky, and who also was an investor in Geiger and Fialkoff.
Okay.
So we knew Max very well.
Who were the other investors in, how many investors were there in Geiger and Fialkoff?
I would imagine probably about 20.
Hmm. So not enough so you could know each and every person.
Yes.
Were they mostly individuals or were there some institutions or?
The only institution that invested was Colin Loeb Rhodes, was a financial institution.
Which is but an
individuals,
investment bank or
individuals,
something?
Individuals, investment bankers.
Yeah.
People I knew who served on the board of General Instrument when I was on the board. And so a group of them, including the Canadian, can't get his name right away. I'm going to be 88 next month. And remembering is tough. Mm-hmm.
But there was a clear, there was a group of Californians in the mix for Geiger and Fialkoff. So you had Max Pilevsky.
Jay Last.
Jay Last. Art Rock.
Arthur Rock.
Were there any others from that California group that you can recall?
No, there was one from Texas. He had an Egyptian name.
Oh, yes. Seraphim?
Fayez Seraphim.
Fayez
Seraphim.
Seraphim.
And who's still running major. He put a college, Rice University, into Geiger and Fialkoff.
Okay.
And he was an investor as well.
And he seems very tied in with Arthur Rock also.
Partners, practically.
Yeah. But based all that time in Texas.
Yes.
I guess he must be part of that Instruments and Oil.
He was an oil
group.
Married into a major oil family.
Okay. Well, so in the life of Geiger and Fialkoff, 7 years, was it the case that the first years of the fund figuring out which firms to invest in and then the other half of it, sort of nurturing them?
Helping them prosper, and so on. you know, Microsemi, you know, we distributed a lot of Microsemi stock when we liquidated, and that company turned out very well.
Was the investment that you made in this semiconductor equipment firm, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly, Zynetics, X-Y-Netics?
X-Y-N-E-T-I-C-S.
Yeah, how do you pronounce that?
Zynetics.
Zynetics. Was that through Geiger and Fialkov?
Yes, and Arthur Rock was an investor in that as well.
Separately from
Yeah, he was on the board, I was on the board.
Where was that based?
In California.
In California. Mm.
And they had two operations, one making probes. There are two public companies that ultimately, we sold them to, I think, United Technologies, who later spun them off into two companies, one in the probe business, and I can dig up the names.
I think I have them. Yeah. Electroglass.
Electroglass was one.
And Ultratech.
And Ultratech. You had them.
So if Geiger and Fialkov ran from 68 to 75, this investment with Zynetics was toward the earlier part of the time frame?
Yes. Zynetics was run by somebody who had once worked for me. Phil and me, Bert Cohen, and they were in the Los Angeles area. And they were originally an automatic design company of semiconductor circuits and chips, and was really a drafting machine.
It was a plotter. Is that
yeah.
what the X, Y
right.
is? Yeah.
Which had been done all by hand before then. And so that was their first major product. And, you know, we followed that. And then they acquired these other companies, Ultratech and Electroglass. And it was sold to General Signal.
Right.
And General Signal ultimately spun them off into two companies which became public companies and are still in existence.
So under the before Zynetics was sold to General Signal, it had acquired
Ultratech.
Electroglass and Ultratech.
Right.
Now there was another, what I couldn't figure out was there was a very important company called in the semiconductor equipment field called GCA that made, I think, steppers, you know, the lithography tools, GCA. And I believe that they were, at some point, became part of the whole mix with Zynetics and Electroglass and Ultratech.
That was before my time.
Or may have been when they were with General Signal.
Might
that
have
they
been.
Added that in.
I wasn't familiar with
okay.
them at all.
Okay.
Afterward, right?
It was.
So your investment in Zynetics was 68, 69, something like that?
It was very early
very
in
early.
Geiger and Fialkov.
Probably 68.
Yeah. If any of you would like coffee or water or orange juice, just let me know.
Okay.
Should I turn this off for a moment?
Sure.
Let me just turn these off for a